Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And for all of you who have not had enough sweets through all the holidays, we're going to bring you even some more.
More sweet stuff.
More sweet stuff. It's sweets for the sweet, as Peter likes to say. But they're different kinds of sweets. And the first up, it's sweet fruit. It's called Fruitful Four Seasons of Fresh Fruit Recipes. And by Brian Nicholson and Sarah Huck. Let's listen now to Brian and Sarah.
From and they're real fruit growers.
Yes.
From Red Jacket Farms in Seneca, New York. And she, as far as I can tell, she either used to work for him or she still does work for him. And she had the idea of doing this book.
This book arrived just as I began to have hopes of warmer weather, and it's called Fruitful. Four Seasons of Fresh Fruit Recipes by Brian Nicholson and Sarah Huck. And Brian is writing from Red Jacket Orchards. So we're talking orchards, we're talking fruit, and the pictures are also luscious. Now, welcomed on the menu, Brian and Sarah. You have a very interesting introduction or foreword by Daniel Hume, and boy, he knows. You can't get, but I think he's one of the most brilliant chefs I've ever met. And he has nothing but wonderful things to say about your operation, your orchard, your farm.
He did. He said some great stuff. We love his introduction.
And then you, Brian, you did your foreword as well, I mean your introduction, and you gave us the history. Why don't you just recount that history a little bit for us of this wonderful experience, the farm experience and the growing of fruit?
Sure, I'd love to. So I'm actually third generation, which puts me in that part of the business where the family looks at the third generation and hopes they don't run it into the ground, as I've been told. I have a high bar to climb over. But really, my grandparents came up here in 1958. They were actually pushed out of their turkey funds they owned in Long Island through eminent domain. The city was expanding highways. This is the Robert Moses era. They literally lost their farm. But they had fallen in love with the area that we now live in called the Finger Lakes. And my grandparents came up here for conferences and all that through Cornell and veterinary outreach. And they found this beautiful farm. My grandparents answered an ad in the New York Times for property in Geneva, New York, and my grandfather came up with my dad. And in fact, my dad tells a little bit of that story in his intro, that coming to a farm in the middle of the winter and realizing that the owner wasn't there, he was down in Florida, I guess. They fell in love with that concept, because coming out of raising poultry, you get to be there all the time. And this concept of a farm actually going into a dormant winter state, my dad fell in love with the concept. But they came up here and moved the family sight unseen, and we've been farming the land ever since.
Well, you went away for a while, but you were drawn back, right?
Yeah, went to college, and my folks were always, and my dad in particular, was always like, go out in the world, explore. He'd like to say, learn on someone else's dime before you consider coming back. And I did. I spent a lot of time in New York City in particular, and it was right an amazing period of New York City when the local food movement was really just at its infancy, and we had really just begun selling our products in the farmers markets in the New York City green market system.
Now, Sarah, how did you get involved? You are a trained chef.
Yeah, I moved to New York about 12 years ago, and I went to the food studies program at NYU, and I kind of got involved in the food scene through there. I mean, it was sort of this, like, confluence of all these people that were really interested in food and food ways and where food comes from. And
I love that degree, by the way, of that whole program.
Oh, it was such an exciting place to be. And, you know, at that time, Brian, it was like people were really just starting to see food in a different way. The farmers markets were really starting to boom. And I was just sort of ready to soak up everything. And so culinary school, I did some cooking. I worked in some restaurants. And then I worked at the green market on the weekends. And one of the farmers I started working for on Saturdays was Red Jacket Orchards at the Williamsburg market on Saturdays.
Uh-huh.
So I was literally selling their fruit, and I had just begun transitioning from working as a private chef to doing some recipe testing work with Melissa Clark, who is a very...
Oh, I love Melissa.
Yes, she's amazing. I mean, she's taught me so much over the years, and so it was a really great person to sort of very serendipitously end up working with.
Do you stay as slim as Melissa actually stays?
Well, this is, I don't know how she does it. She has a huge appetite and a tiny little figure. It's true. She's a lucky woman with a high metabolism, I guess.
Well, I heard she's really, really, she's full of self-control.
Well, I've seen her picking at shortbread dough plenty over the years. She has self-control, I suppose. She's very passionate about food and eating. So I was working with Red Jacket, and I just really loved everything about the family. They had their history. They had so much integrity and so much dedication to what they were doing, and it was very inspiring. And I was also just amazed by the sheer variety of choices they offered. You know, we kind of talked about this, but the microclimate that the orchard is in really enables them to grow fruit that you might not see from other growers in the area. In fact, which you don't see from other growers in the area. So they have, you know, the apricots and the peaches and the plums and the grapes and the berries and the gooseberries. I mean, it's pretty much anything that's not tropical, really. And I thought to myself that it was like a really so much potential to like really educate consumers about fruit and offer them a chance to see what you could do with it. I was interacting with all these customers at the market who were constantly saying, you know, what's this and what do I do with this and how does this taste? And it felt like a walking cookbook in and of itself. And so I thought, there might be something here.
Yeah, maybe there's a cookbook. But I want to come back to Brian because this is almost like Rip Van Winkle in reverse. If you follow what I'm saying, I mean, founding an orchard in the 1950s, sight unseen. I mean, it sounds almost fanciful, don't you think? I mean, if you looked at from the outside, why would you do that?
Well, it's a really unique, that's a great question, Peter. Well, actually, the farm actually was planted in 1911, so it was an ongoing operation that my grandparents purchased.
Yeah, but they didn't know anything about the fruit growing, did they?
They knew nothing. Yeah, that was to your point there, I guess I come from a long, we like to say we have a long line of contrarian blood in the family.
Not
so my grandfather did have a horticulture degree from SUNY Farmingdale, and so I think he had a lot of confidence in what he could do. And my dad said it was a lot of harsh winters when they started out. He was planting shrubbery. He was planting a lot of different things. But we were fortunate enough, I guess, to inherit 100 acres at that time of some really unique products that were probably very common back then, but like sour cherries. I mean, there was actually a sour cherry cannery on site. And the one thing my dad loves in particular, I think, the fact that we're a bit of living history in the sense that there's points along the lake in Seneca Lake. So Seneca Lake really is the anchor of our unique microclimate, being 700 feet deep and 30 miles long. It's one of the largest inland bodies of water, and it has quite an impact on the immediate climate. But when the Indians were growing fruit along the shores, they had learned it from the French, and there was plum growing and peach growing, and it kind of went away for a while. And I think our farm was a bit of a string to the history there. And now we're growing on over 600 acres, so it's exciting. I mean, I'll give you a quick unique fun fact. If you dip your toe in Seneca Lake, it is connected by the canal system to New York City. So we've always been connected to New York City in some fashion.
You put your fruit on a boat and send it down the canal.
Well, right. If I remember correctly, wasn't it that part of the reason it went away was because the railroad was built, right? Like out to California, and so the ships used to come up to Seneca Lake, and then part of that started to go away when there were other ways of transporting food.
You bet. The greatest technological advance that changed fruit growing on the East Coast was a small improvement called the ice box car. So, one of the original ones is in Sacramento at the Train Museum, and it really, I've gone and seen it, and it kind of is amazing because it is part of the history up here. Once that technology developed, obviously California has an amazing growing climate for fruit and now can ship it to the east. But we're still a part of the local movement here and being that sort of fruit basket for New York. We take a lot of pride in that.
Well, and listen, like, there's nothing better than having fruit that's been picked perfectly ripe and then brought to your market, because you can't you just can't do that and ship the fruit. It's too fragile. I know, like, I remember you telling me the story about, you know, the strawberries and how you guys have to pick the strawberries so carefully and pack them so carefully because they can't get crushed just going down from Geneva to New York City.
Yeah, we kind of like the overnight FedEx of fruit for the city. And that's a good point, Sarah. I mean, we take a lot of, we say we're the fruit express because we, like, strawberries, we're in the field at 5 a.m. till about noon. After noon, it gets a little too hot, and then the strawberries get too soft. So basically, we pick it, get it right in the cooler, and then it's on a truck that night and on our stands and in the restaurants that we work with down in New York City the next day. And it does allow us to pick fruit at the peak of flavor. And my dad is a nut about that. I mean,
your dad is all hands and dirt and heart and soul.
He is.
And you said the cookbook is this apricot tree. Now, why is it that your father would want to teach everybody how to plant an apricot tree?
Oh, my God, that's a great question. Well, I think because along the lines of, I think identifying something that you're passionate about, right? So, you know, it's taking something that it's unexpected as well. So ability to take an item like that and put it in the ground and nurture it and produce this product that he was basically told there's no way you can do it. And it took him and his father about 30 years to figure out the right place to put it and the right rootstock to put it on and how to make sure we get a crop every year on it and how to protect it from the frost. But through that challenge, through that struggle comes this piece of fruit that when you rip it open and you can squeeze it and the juice runs out of it, you've tasted nothing like it.
Right.
Who wouldn't want to
do something? Yeah, because most every apricot you get,
the problem is they're
dry. You know, it's almost like chewing on a piece of plastic. I mean, there's a little bit of apricot flavor, but a juicy apricot, I don't know that I don't think I've had one of those for a very long time.
Now, back to your cookbook, first of all, you've organized it over four seasons because you, in fact, do produce fruit, which, again, is a miracle from my perspective, through all those seasons, right?
That's right. I mean, so I think the specific growing regions are periods that we have. But, you know, a lot of orchards specialize, and I think Sarah kind of said this, in, you know, maybe one, two, or three different items. And we joke that we're harvesting, like, rhubarb in June, and we're harvesting nonstop then all the way through the end of, really into November on apple.
And then make apple juice or something.
Right? That's right. We make apple juice. We make apple sauce. We make apple butter. We freeze products. We can take it out. We puree the apricots, and we make an awesome apricot juice out of it. It is this ability to work. And, you know, fruit is an amazing character. I think Sarah will agree with this, that it freezes very well. You know, it holds its nutrients and it holds its flavor quite well in the freezer.
I freeze mangoes.
Oh, wow.
Mangoes are great because they have that nice custardy flavor.
Oh, yeah, because they usually have them on sale at the farmer's market.
She also freezes cherries. I mean, the best. That's your best creation.
Yeah,
with cherries.
I have to pit them first. He doesn't like pits.
Well, of course, you have to pit them first.
I need to find a good pitter. I mean, they're hard.
But it's a great invention to have them. I mean, thawed overnight, that tastes as good as fresh cherries.
Yeah. Sarah,
it's
you
really
started
true.
To say something about a pitter. any
well,
respect?
You know, Anne, I just got an email setting up right before this call of a woman who just found our stuff, our tart cherry juice she found in Minneapolis at a store called Kowalski's. And she sent me an email and she said, I'm going to try using this instead of pitting cherries so I can make some jam. So we'll see how it comes
out. Now, throughout this book, you have, there are two things I want to say. One, the recipes are not like just the farmer's cookbook. I mean, they're very sophisticated recipes here. I'm looking at one, a freak of salad with red currants, arugula, golden beets, and feta. I mean, most people haven't even heard of freaka.
It's true.
And then you have also these growing tips, which has to be worth it for anybody interested in growing anything. I mean, this has to be a boon of information learned over a lifetime of experience. Joe's growing tip.
You know what? I'm so glad you brought that up. And I have to recognize Sarah at this point of the process because she, part of this journey, and this book has, I don't know if we've mentioned, this book took, this is a decade-long sort of love affair with wanting to kind of do this. Sarah,
almost like an apricot tree, almost.
Sarah had been working and cajoling us to maybe do this for years. And, you know, you can imagine my dad and I running the business and all that. We're like, oh, it sounds like a good idea, but we're pretty busy. And Sarah did an amazing job of cajoling my father in particular about sitting down with him at the kitchen table at the farmhouse, yeah, and helping him kind of do, you know, put out on paper what he just does innately and is done innately for 40 years, and that's not an easy process, so I want to thank Sarah for that. That was a special thing that she's brought to the book, and my dad, you know, labored over some of those tips and all that. Because,
oh, they're wonderful, though.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that was so special about working with the Nicholsons is how articulate both of you are, and there's this sort of, like, beautiful balance. You know, like, I think about Joe, and he's kind of this, like, Renaissance farmer type of person. I think, I don't know, Brian, you might agree with this, but he's so creative, and he, you know, he'd tell me about how he wants to plant these, like, 18th century orchards and, you know, the espalier, and how he, you know, but at the same time, he's really pragmatic. He knows about science and soil, and I remember sitting at that kitchen table, and he was explaining to me, you know, the lake effect that we were talking about earlier with the Seneca Lake, and it was just, it was really actually very easy to sort of get to the heart of everything with you, and it felt like a real honor to be able to do that.
Well, I love the word Renaissance. That's a great word. I've used a lot of words to describe my dad, but I haven't used Renaissance, so I think you'd appreciate it.
Renaissance Joe, that's the new word.
I'll tell you, if there's one reason to buy this book, is there's a recipe for maraschino cherries, which is like for real, not plastic cherries.
Oh, right, the actual, and, you know, and it's funny because it's such an easy thing to do, and I think that's true of so much cooking in general. You know, people see these things in jars and cans on the shelves, and they think that because it's been done in a processing plant somewhere so far away that it must be really hard. And some of the most delicious things out there are really just the most simple. And I think, for example, the fruit itself is delicious all on its own, but then you take something and you can add a little sugar and make the freshest jam if you've got the best quality product to start with. If you have delicious food, it's really easy to make something wonderful out of it.
We just need, before we close, we need to complete the story.
Yes.
Because surely this Adventures in Fruit with Red Jacket Orchards is going to go on. But, Brian, assure us there's another generation that's interested in the business and is going to continue it when you're gone.
Wow. There are now five in the wings. Very, very young. They are my little juice mix masters, I call them. My kids mix up every morning. I always have, of course, all the fruit juices in the fridge, and they spend a lot of time mixing them up. So right now they're enamored, of course, by what Daddy does. I bring home the fruit juice, and they love the juice. So right now, Peter, I would say we're in a good shape, but they're under the nine and under, so I can't guarantee what's going to happen when they get a little older. But I think to answer that, though, when I grew up as a kid, it was not fun or exciting or glamorous at all to be associated with a farm. And it just in the past decade alone, to see the evolution of how people relate to their food. And I now really feel that's a long-term trend, and it's good for all of us.
I think there's a secret here. I think you need to take just a small amount of the dirt and mix it in with the fruit juice, and then they'll be connected forever.
That sounds terrible, right?
Yeah, we try and keep the dirt out of the fruit juice.
Well,
but I get what you're saying.
This is overall and from all fronts an amazing book, as far as I can tell.
An amazing achievement.
I also have to give credit to a lot of there were so many chefs and part of the larger community that just really stepped up and opened up their kitchens to us and helped us. Gave us Dan Barber, who's like a big farm champion, and
we know Dan, yeah.
Yeah, and you know Danielle Ballou Andrew Feinberg and Francine Stevens from Franny's in Brooklyn. I mean, so many people that really care about farms that were just so thrilled to participate, and that I think that was really gratifying.
It was a community effort.
Well, the book is, as I said, it's a marvel, amazing, should be in every kitchen.
Well, thank you.
I want to come and live on the farm for a little bit. I used to do that when I was a child.
Well, you're more than welcome to visit us. You're not far away. We'd love to host you.
Thank you so much, Brian, and thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Don't you think that's just such an absolutely charming story?
It certainly is.
And they're just such wonderful, warm-hearted people. And nice guys do finish first, sometimes. And I forgot to say it's time for a break, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, sweetheart, welcome back. And who's up next?
Yeah, well, we're moving on to another suite. This being donuts, we're going to be talking to Kamal Grant, who's a born and bred Southerner, highly educated in the culinary arts, and he found his calling, however, in donuts.
When we tell you that his shop's named Sublime Donuts, you can probably figure out that he's onto a pretty good thing, and people love it, and he's giving away all the secrets as to how you can make them for yourself.
Well, all you listeners, just admit it. You like to sneak about getting donuts, but this book called Homemade Donuts, Techniques and Recipes for Making Sublime Donuts in Your Own Kitchen, means that Kamal Grant, the author, has enabled you to stop that sneaking around. You could just come right out and satisfy your donut lust. Kamal, how did you get involved with donuts? So tell us, first of all, about you have a very important bakery shop, and it's received all kinds of, I don't know, like a cult following and adulation from senior people, people saying that Dana Collins said it's the best breakfast of the world. How did you get to this?
I've always loved donuts as a child, so I grew up eating donuts. I think that's kind of what spurred my interest in the baking and pastry arts. So, as a youth, I wanted to be a baker and a pastry chef, so I went to the Navy and baked in the Navy and from food around the world, and then went to the Culinary Institute of America after the Navy and learned the baking and pastry arts, and then after that went to the American Institute of Baking, where I learned the science behind baking.
So no wonder
I had a love for donuts, so it was kind of like I wanted to create my own donuts. So I found a little donut shop, Elise, and started making donuts I like and seen if everybody else likes them. And so far, people have been liking them.
I gather that.
They've been liking them a whole lot, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, and I told your publicist when we were booking this interview, I said to him, are you also sending donuts? And he totally dismissed it.
Oh, too bad.
Dallin, he came back at me and he said, I don't know about the donuts. They just disappeared mysteriously.
Donuts tend to do that when they're around.
You have two shops, and I find almost everything about you intriguing, to be perfectly honest. But who would have thought your original shop is in Atlanta? Since you were born near there and raised near there, that's not too surprising. But then your other one is in Bangkok?
Yeah, Bangkok. That's where our second franchise location is at. A gentleman from Bangkok, I guess he was, cruising the internet and ran across a post that said our donuts were the best in the world, and he wanted to open up a donut franchise and gave us a call, and he's a great guy, so we were talking, and it sounded great to him and great to me, so we made it work, and now the shop is up and running, so.
Wow. They love
sweets in Bangkok, so.
Now, he's running it. You're not running it. You're just franchising the name to him?
Yeah, I just franchised. I went up there and trained the staff and everything and showed them how to make Sublime Donuts. So, that's what they're doing now.
Well, now, what all do you cover in this book? I love this quote here, by the way, from Patrick Koo. The donut is the street thug of the pastry world, strutting past Madeleine and Eclair.
Yes, I like that too, because donuts don't get respect as other pastries do. Like other pastries, like croissants and other things, Madeleines and Eclairs, you can go to a bakery and they'll charge you $3, $4, $5 for them. But for a donut, it's made out of the same flour and sugar and butter that those things are made of. But people are like, no, I want 50 cents for that. So donuts are kind of the thugs of the pastry world, where they got to take their own respect. So that's kind of what we feel like we're doing here with the donut book, and with, you know, Sublime Donuts is adding class to the donut. So now the donut can put on the top hat and sit up there with, you know, the Madeleines and the eclairs and stuff.
Now, what's the deal with donuts? Do you go by one? You can't really go by one donut, can you? I suppose you can, but it's sort of like
the beauty about donuts is, you go to McDonald's or something, you just buy yourself a hamburger. But when you go to a donut shop, you normally buy donuts for other people. Donuts make you happy and make you want to share. Donuts are the, you know, kind of like the original share food. So you buy a dozen donuts and you make friends. That's kind of what people do when they come by the donut shop. With the book, you know, you can make donuts and then you want to pass them out to your friends. So that's always good. Make friends with the donut book.
So you can buy one.
Yeah, you can if you so want to. But
most people don't.
The strategy for Krispy Kreme apparently was that they were always outside of major centers, so that you had to drive, and you'd get there, and the smell would be wonderful, and you'd buy a dozen of Krispy Kreme donuts, and then you were tempted, and you would eat them before you got home. So the next time, you would buy two dozen of the Krispy Kreme donuts and eat one.
Try to buy more than you need.
this picture of you're looking so contemplative and philosophical, very serious. And so rightfully, you start off this book with the history of the donut.
Mm-hmm.
What is interesting about the history of the donut?
One of the interesting things, well, a couple of interesting things, is that Washington Irving, the first, you know, written word of the donut is by Washington Irving, you know, the author of Sleepy Hollow and stuff, The Headless Horseman. So he wrote a book called The History of New York, and he spoke about a grand feast, and he spoke about how there are donuts on there. He spelled it D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T-S, which I like to think of as the traditional and real spelling of donuts. Another interesting fact is really the popularity of the donut is, it really goes back to the World Wars, you know. We're at war. The Salvation Army was over there to feed the hungry soldiers, and they would make them donuts. So when all the boys came back from war, they had a hankering for donuts to start their own businesses. So a lot of them opened up standalone donut shops, and that's kind of what made the American palate really want and love donuts, because all these guys loved donuts over there when at war. So when they came back, they made donuts, and then everybody just really started loving donuts.
You start out with letting people know what equipment they need and so forth and so on. And then I just didn't know it was that complicated, your donut-making techniques, rolling out the – and then you have making cutouts, hand-shaping, the snail, the waffle technique. I mean, it seems endless, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways you can take donuts. That's what I like to say. That's part of bringing class in it. That's part of putting on the top hat of the donuts. You don't just have to have a donut one way, you know, with a hole in it tossed in granulated sugar. You know, you can do it many different ways. So there's many different shapes and size and techniques that you can use. If you're used to cookie making and you have, you know, all these cutouts for cookies, you can cut the sort of similar shapes out in donuts and make interesting shapes of donuts.
And there are different kinds of dough. Uh-huh. I didn't know that either. I mean, you've got Tato yeast donut. I guess there's a basic donut pastry, right? And but there are all kinds of other possibilities if you really get into it.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of room you can go for what particular flavor you like. Like, you know, with the because down here in the South, we like soft donuts, like you said, Krispy Kreme, and like a soft yeast-raised donut. So yeast-raised donuts tend to be softer, and that's like bread-style donuts. But north and the northern places, they like denser donuts, and those are traditionally cake donuts because they can be dense and crispy. So, you know, you can, there's many different variations within yeast raised donuts and cake style donuts.
Well, I like your pie crust donuts.
Yeah, how do you get the, I always wondered how you got the jam in the middle. How did you get the jelly in the jelly donut?
How do you get the jam? Well, you poke a little hole. You can poke a little hole and then take a pastry bag and then squeeze it in.
So you're squeezing
it after it's fried, though. After it's fried and cooled.
Right, but it's funny. There always seems to be a lot inside it for a very small hole.
Well, you know, this will probably upset you enormously, but growing up, my grandmother made this deep-fried dough ball, and Italian, and she would put her thumb in and stuff it with an anchovy and then sprinkle it with powdered sugar.
No, that sounds great. I mean,
wonderful.
She loves it. I love it. You know what I'm saying? That's what I like to say. There's all types of ways of donuts. Every culture has fried dough, so you can do donuts in there's a million possibilities in donuts.
But anchovy donuts are going to be probably going to be on the menu at Sublime Donut pretty soon.
Anchovy donuts could be on the menu because every April Fool's we like to do sort of spins on weird donuts. So we would do things that you won't think of as a donut and try to make them in donuts. So sort of like, so we're going to do a fish donut for April Fool's, like a salmon, lox salmon, and cream cheese. And we did like a buffalo chicken mousse donut. And then we toss it in powdered ranch dressing. So there's all types of ways you can play with
donuts. You're very creative. I mean, your glazes and icings are not just routine. I mean, they're really very sophisticated.
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite here?
What's my favorite? I really love peanut butter and chocolate combination. So
yeah.
The peanut butter glaze, and you can do a peanut butter glaze donut with a milk chocolate drizzle, or you know, a chocolate yeast raised donut. So that's exciting to me.
And
the candied bacon is just standalone.
Oh,
great,
yeah,
so.
You do have a section here where you have things like that, where people can learn how to make candied bacon and the pistachio icing with real pistachios and.
Instead of having just regular old sprinkles, you know, little jimmies, we want to sprinkle things that are delicious. So we got, candied bacon is great. Chop that up and sprinkle it on the donut.
Now, you actually go around the world with donut-style things. What are some of your favorite interesting ones there?
Zeppoli. Zeppolis are great. I love a good Zeppoli. The ricotta filling. That's delicious. And then churros. Who doesn't love a churro? I mean, I can make it all over because I love donuts, so that's really what it is.
Yeah, there wouldn't be any question of what you'd have for breakfast in Spain, right?
Definitely not.
Well, I mean, some of these are really very, as I said, sophisticated, such as carrot sprinkles. I don't know, I might classify that the same way I classify carrot cake. It's a real letdown because it looks like it's going to be a real cake.
Yeah, carrot sprinkle. That's the best way to get your carrots. That's what I said.
But toffee is one of my weaknesses, and you have one of those, too.
Yes, that's good also. That's now, a winner.
Are you ever tempted to do something like, what's his name in New York, Dominique Ansel with the cronut?
Yeah, I mean, we've played around with croissants here. We've actually got a frosted croissant on the menu that we've had for years before the actual cronut popularity. So I like to think that was ahead of the cronut, but, you know, he's in New York, so they get all the big press up there. But I'm just glad that he brought light to the donuts. As long as anyone that brings light to donuts makes it good for all donut makers.
There you go. Now, but you don't travel with your cronuts having their own seat on the plane.
No.
Who was that? It was some celebrity or other.
Really? That's funny.
I thought you told me about it.
You said
there was some celebrity, like maybe it's Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, probably.
She's marrying a donut. She's getting rid of her husband and marrying a donut.
That's amazing.
I didn't pay attention to things like that.
Like a woman after my heart.
It's only because it was on the Today Show this morning. I'm currently giving you away our joint ages by telling you that it was amusing that Matt Lauer was interviewing Elton John on the Today Show recently, all about the 40th anniversary of the first album I think I ever bought my wife.
Oh, really? Wow.
Called Yarrow Brick Road. They just reissued it this week.
Wonderful.
Oh, we still that's have, amazing. We still congratulations have, also. So,
yeah,
wow.
we're still alive. It's amazing, isn't it?
Beautiful. beautiful
you know,
thing.
I think that you already know what you're doing, and I don't think you need any advice from me.
Always love advice.
Now look at that page. What's the opposite page? What? It's the one with the star and the...
It's 166, opposite page 167.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you were having fun with your pastry dough thing.
I would think you shouldn't publish all your secrets in this book so that the people come and just buy the stuff in this
book. I guess that is true, but we like to, people still, even though we put a lot of information, I don't know if they can still recreate the love and the beauty that we put into the donuts here at Sublime Donuts. So, I mean, that's hard to capture. I try to put that in the book form, but, you know, the love and dedication that I put in donuts, I don't know.
I have a feeling that, in fact, what happens is it increases the donut carrying capacity of a particular crowd of people because they realize just exactly how much work it is
and what a bargain
a Sublime Donut or a box of Sublime Donuts actually is.
Exactly. That's what I like to say. Any more light on donuts makes us all popular, you know. It broadens the pie. It increases the pie, you know. So if they see the book, they're going to look at all the delicious donuts and they can sit it on their coffee table and they're going to be like, I don't really want to go in the kitchen, but we can drive 5 minutes down the street and go get us a donut. So
there you go. Well, I think we're going to have to get you talking to Matt Lauer or Willard Scott or Al Roker or something like that on the Today Show. We'll mail that to their suggestion box.
I would appreciate it.
Because it seems like to me like you have a fabulous story to tell. And a great product.
How do you get them?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, you have to go to Sublime Donuts, of course.
You have to go to Sublime Donuts if you're not going to make your own? Do you fulfill orders on your internet?
No. You got to come to the shop and get the donuts.
And the shop is located?
In Atlanta, Georgia.
That's a big place.
And everybody normally has layovers in Atlanta, so, you know, Atlanta's got a busy airport, so you might as well, you know, extend your layover, drive down to the donut shop and come get a donut.
And, well, tell us where it is. I mean, don't keep it a secret.
It's at 535 10th Street Northwest, Atlanta, Georgia, 30318. So, or you can always check us out online at www.sublimedonuts.com and check out the little donut shop that could.
There you go.
I'm assuming that you've declined and you're not sending me any of these, right?
Donuts don't ship well. They don't ship so well. But you got the book, so you can recreate the love and passion.
I can just see me doing that. I'm making chicken soup today. After I make the chicken soup, I'll make some donuts.
Awesome.
Well, this is really an eye-opening exploration of the possibilities of this fried dough. Yeah. And I wish you continued success, and I look forward, maybe you'll get some franchising around other cities and be good for all of us.
Yeah, definitely will be. I'll be around your neck of the woods in no time.
Okay, Kamal Grant, lots of luck to you, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after this short.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest has the most romantic name I think I've ever heard, Amber Rose. And she's a Kiwi living in London, and she has a little bit of something extra to the sweet subject. She has recipes that are also healthful and nutritious. They look mouth-wateringly divine, actually. But I'll believe it. If she tells me they're healthy, that's great.
And as I told her at the end of the interview, her son's name is Ollie. He's 9 years old right now, and he's never leaving home.
We've got a refreshing food writer, cookbook author, born and raised in New Zealand, actually now London-based, Amber Rose. Welcome to On the Menu. Your book is just lovely, Love, Bake, Nourish, Healthier Cakes, Bakes, and Desserts.
and full of fruit and flavor. Now, you were explaining a few minutes ago why this is so, because growing up, that's what you were exposed to on your mother's very large organic farm and orchards. This obviously has influenced your work quite a bit.
Yeah, it really influenced me in a huge way. I kind of grew up just experimenting all year round. I think baking was kind of where it started as well. I mean, I love cooking and baking, but I think as a child, baking with all the wonderful fruits in my mother's garden, decorating with all the beautiful flowers and things, really was kind of what has inspired a lifelong passion, really.
You have been described as Britain's most glamorous baker. What does that mean?
I don't know. You tell me.
I don't know, but your publisher sent me that description.
I guess maybe, I don't know, if I were to think about it from an English point of view, I guess there's quite a few well-known bakers over here, i.e. Mary Berry from the Great British Bake Off, but they're, you know, she's been around quite a long time, Mary Berry. So I guess it's maybe I'm just the next kind of, you know, few generations down coming through, I don't know, with quite a different style, I guess. There's not really been many cookbooks or baking books in particular with my kind of style, so I don't know, maybe that's what they mean.
I think maybe it's a reaction to the two fat ladies.
Yeah.
On their maybe, motorcycles.
Maybe. No, the last one just died of those two.
Yeah, right, ladies, right.
You know? Hey, that's Nick's and right, yeah, yes, that was tragic.
Yes. Amber, you in your introduction say this book is like, even though there are oceans of baking books out there, yours is totally different. Could you explain why you say that, or why is it different?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I guess in a way it's different, but in a way it's going back to our roots, because I feel like a lot, or pretty much all the bakers out there use kind of modern processed white flour, and they sweeten the cakes with modern kind of processed sugar. And I guess my, or even, you know, if you get some gluten-free baking books, which can be great, they still are filled with sugar. And I just felt like people are becoming a lot more health conscious, and there's a lot of people out there with allergies and various things. And I felt like, because of the way I was brought up with this huge influence on kind of natural and lots of fruit and vegetables, and that's the way I've always baked, that I wanted to show people that it's possible to still have kind of beautiful decadent treats, but that they can also support your health. So I guess that was kind of the angle that I wanted to come from, and show people that you can still have treats and yet they can still be good for you.
So you're taking the sweetness from the fruit, but it's really funny. We've interviewed at least one or two people who are saying, I'm a huge improvement in desserts because I'm using real sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup.
So exactly, yeah.
They feel like they're making a huge contribution just by using something as natural as sugar and molasses, and you're saying we don't have to even count on that.
Well, I guess there are varying degrees of sugar. Like some sugars, they're kind of raw, natural sugars, and they have a lot more of the trace minerals and micronutrients in them. Whereas if you're using kind of really bleached white sugar, then obviously there's kind of nothing left in it. But if you use maple syrup, is a great sweetener. Which
yeah, you like that a lot. I noticed you have a section on explaining that in the book, maple syrup.
Yeah. The maple syrup's great. I mean, it can be quite expensive, but honey is also fantastic. And then, you know, some of the wonderful kind of sugars, as you say, you know, coconut sugar is amazing. Raw date syrup is wonderful as well, which is a lot cheaper than maple syrup. And then some of the unrefined kind of cane sugars can also be great. Still, molasses and all those kind of trace minerals still in them.
It has
a lot of flavor and stuff as well.
Do you use treacle?
I haven't in Love, Bake, Nourish, but I sometimes do. I have to say, a bit of butter and treacle on the crumpet, you can't go wrong.
Right. The only reason I mention is I've always wanted to get this into a program, and Anne will say, well, it's not relevant at all, but there's a wonderful series of art galleries across the United Kingdom. The biggest one, of course, on Millbank in London, and I didn't realize until maybe we made our last trip over there, and we've been to the Tate umpteen times, that in fact, the entire fortune that allows the Tate collection to be free to the public was all made based on sugar and treacle.
I never knew that.
The Tate and Lyle Company, based in, I think, Liverpool, that's the name. That's where the name came from.
Tate and Lyle, yeah.
You never knew that. You learn a little something every time you're on this program.
You do.
Amber, to get people exactly sort of in the same neighborhood as where you're coming from, I think we should just mention a little bit some of the various things that you did and experiences you've had. You grew up as part of a counterculture, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You have a lot of new age abilities and inclinations. You trained in herbal medicine and massage therapy. Yeah. I don't know how this traveling to China fits in. but you were shimming up
the lychee trees. Yeah.
And roaming local food markets. We worked a while in a bakery in Melbourne. And we lived there, by the way, for a while.
Melbourne's a great city, isn't it? Yeah. Lots of wonderful food.
It's amazing. And then you went to London, take a job as a nanny and a personal cook to Jude Law and Sadie Frost. Now, that ought to have been interesting.
Yeah.
but you were intent on creating light, healthy dishes for the children. And then you had a child yourself, and then you trained as a doula, which is, what do we call it, doula? What do we call them in the States?
I have no
it's
idea.
Kind of like a midwife, but you're not. It's a bit different than a midwife.
Yeah, how is it different? I'm not sure, but I know it is different.
Well, a midwife is responsible for the healthy, and a doula is there as an emotional and practical support person of the mother.
I see.
Although I have actually delivered babies in emergency situations, but it's not actually my job.
So anyhow, in addition to being a cookbook author and baker and cook, you also are a masseuse, a nutritionist, and a doula.
Yeah. Sounds like quite a lot, doesn't it?
It does, actually.
Yeah. I guess to me they all kind of tie into one another in various different ways. And I guess the style of my cooking is very nourishing. That kind of was a big part of when I was working as a doula. I would cook a lot for people. And then the massage as well is just kind of another way of nurturing yourself and looking after yourself. And then the nutrition. So they all kind of tie in various different ways. But it's the cooking that's always really been my true kind of passion, which I always seem to come back to the cooking and the baking.
Well, the images, I don't even know how to put this, but the photography, the images of these desserts in your book, they look delicious, absolutely delicious.
Oh, thank you.
But also, they look sort of guilt-free, and I don't know quite how to reconcile the two.
Well, this is it. It's funny that you should say that, actually, because what I feel like is there's a kind of conventional style of baking on one side, and then you have the kind of ultra-healthy, ultra-kind of free-from-everything kind of baking down the other side that doesn't look or sound appealing. But I wanted to kind of create something that was going down the middle road, so it still felt like you were having it, but it still nourished you and didn't have any of the bad stuff as well. So it's somewhere in the middle somehow.
Well, it works because I'm dying to taste some of these recipes. You do a lot of things with ancient grains. And while I'm at that, I might mention that throughout the book, you have little segments called A Word About. And one of them happens to be that I'm looking at ancient grains. And you do have it on maple syrup, and you have it on honey. And the coconut oil, I believe, was another one.
Yeah, and eggs as well.
Where did I start saying? I'm trying to remember how I started that whole thing. Ancient grains.
It's quite a good idea to put in the little words about, just because I feel like people often know, okay, you have something that's organic and not organic, and we all know that we should eat healthy and this and that, but sometimes it's nice to have little kind of bite-sized pieces of information that just explain in a friendly way why. I've always been interested in nutrition and understanding the body and how things work, but yeah, I think it's nice for people just to know, well, okay, here's an organic egg and here's a non-organic egg, but why is the other one better?
Well, and you do explain a lot about these different alternative flowers, and you make them sound really important. I think that I would never even think of everything in the United States is like white flour, just about.
Yeah. I mean, I think I think the health industry has grown by something like 500 the last 3 years alone, and I think that with the ancient grains, because so many people have wheat allergies now, and I think that's because the level of gluten in modern processed white flour is so far beyond what it naturally and originally was in some of those ancient grains.
I agree.
People are starting to kind of have reactions to it. They're just ingesting too much gluten and white flour. And what's great about the spelt flour in particular is that it has a lot less gluten in it, so people tend to react less to it. So you can still bake with what is essentially a wonderful kind of flour, but it's the flour is a lot less, has a lot less gluten in it and is a lot more nutritious. So what's great is you can still bake with what is essentially a kind of flour, but it's a flour that's much better for you, and people tend to react to it a lot less. So it still feels like you can have a lovely light sponge cake, for example, but without all the gluten.
Well, you know, I'm very interested in all of your meringues. One of your chapters deals with meringues.
Love meringues.
I
myself a delicious meringue for my birthday the other day.
The recipes look just absolutely divine. When we were living in Australia, my pavlova was perfect. When we moved to the States, I had the same recipe, and I produced one pavlova for a dinner party, and one of the guests said that's the only time she's ever had to struggle to eat a dessert with a fork and a steak knife.
Wow. I love that. That's so great.
But do you use, Peter and I were debating, do New Zealanders claim pavlova as their invention? Because we always thought
I think they do. I think they do. But is that, or maybe they just made it fashionable. I'm not sure, actually. I know the New Zealanders, they love to put kiwi fruit on their meringues, don't they? Which is rather delicious.
Strawberries, kiwi, and passion fruit.
We were told that there are two versions of the invention of pavlova, one based in New Zealand and the other based in Australia. They were both done for the same person who was a dancer of that last name. She was a ballet dancer. I think really the Australians probably really win, because I doubt very much if Anna Pavlova went ballet dancing in New Zealand nearly as much as she did in Australia. But I could be wrong there too.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure about that. But then you have the Swiss meringue, so maybe that throws the cat amongst the pigeons. I don't know.
Looking at your tiered summer berry pavlova, and it has to be a different construct, because kind of pavlova that we had in Australia, it had a chewy center and a crisp exterior, whereas if you were arranging it in tiers like this, it would have to be a pretty stiff meringue.
Well, surprisingly, you can get away with quite a soft center, even on the tiered, as long as your fruit, it can't really sit for a long time. But the one berry pavlova is still pretty chewy in the middle.
Oh, good. Now, you happen to have there's so many things to discuss in this book. You have a love of edible flowers, and you have a note on using those. You particularly like rose petals in a number of things. And then you have a section on herbal teas with Tealicious and tea tasting. And you have this ginger tea. And I must say that has rescued me from food poisoning. I don't know how many times.
Oh, I know. Ginger tea is amazing. Everything about ginger tea is such a wonderful thing.
Well, all in all, I think this is it is unexpected for a baking book, and it needs to be explored in probably more detail than we have time to do now.
Yeah.
But I really need to congratulate you on this. I mean, you use things such as lavender, honey, pistachios, which you adore, pine nuts, hazelnuts. I mean, just absolutely the most marvelous products possible in baking.
I feel like there was an author, an American author actually, who said only ever using white flour is like only ever painting your house one color. And I feel like with baking, it's become such a kind of default that everybody just uses white flour and white sugar, and there is so many wonderful ingredients and nuts and flowers and seeds and honeys and all the things that you just mentioned that one can use in baking. And I just, there's so much at people's fingertips, and it's just nice to kind of explore that, I think, and show people that it is possible.
Now, your son's name is Oli or Ollie?
Ollie. Oliver.
And how old is Ollie right now?
He's actually sitting beside me, being a very good boy and keeping very quiet.
Oh, yes.
He's about to turn 9 in July.
I have news for you. Put your hand over the microphone so Ollie doesn't hear you. I suspect Ollie's never going to leave home.
Yeah. All my friends are very jealous of him. And when I'm at their house on the weekend and we cook, and they're like, Ollie, you're so lucky to have a mom who can cook like this.
I think
he takes it for granted, personally, between you and I.
Yeah, well, he's never moving out, you realize.
Yeah. When he leaves, he'll realize how good it was.
Well, Amber Rose, this is a beautiful, poetic, and delicious book. And
The
title is Love, Bake, and Nourish. And I think it should be in everybody's kitchen that wants to have that sense of beauty and poetry in their lives and in their food.
Yep, thank you. That's just so beautiful. What a wonderful way of describing it.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the menu. And
the weather nice for us until we get to London.
Next week.
Yay, I know. The sun is shining. I'll try and keep it on for you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Amber.
Thank
good
you
luck.
So much.
Yeah, good luck with your book.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
By way of quick explanation, since we didn't mention at the beginning, a kiwi is a New Zealander, no longer an ancient bird applying to the entire population. We just thought you might need that clarification.
Nor fruit.
and now it's time to take a break. And on the other side of the break, see if you can guess between now and then, we're going to have an interview on the subject of America's favorite food.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, did you guess? Did you guess the answer? Here's a book by a young lady who decided that she didn't like ice cream enough, so she'd better find out more and more and more and more different ways to make it. So she collected recipes from ice cream makers all across the country as part of her scoop adventures.
You know, you're the one, Rabideau, who is the geography king.
Yes, yes.
Why don't you do this intro?
Why don't I do the intro? I don't really quite understand, except of course,
the 50 states.
As a geographer, I understand that everything must have a geospatial representation. The first and most important thing is to know where something is on this planet, whether it's ice cream or whatever it is. And so you did a good job, Lindsay.
Clendaniel, is that how you pronounce it?
You are correct.
Good.
Of taking the subject and breaking it down geographically. What a very sensible thing to do.
Yes.
but then I discovered your good sense only continued a certain distance because once you get inside the Midwest, good luck trying to figure out what order the recipes might fall in.
But you're interested in the product anyhow, not the...
Yeah, well, always interested in things geographical, dear. You know that.
Yes. But I might point out that Lindsay has a blog of the same name called Scoop Adventures. You started out, as you introduced this book, loving ice cream anyhow, and then starting to make ice cream, and then wanting to share your ice cream recipes, henceforth the blog. Do you have regulars? Do you have, like, the same people? Like, a lot of blogs end up with kind of a specific audience, and they interact with each other all the time. Is yours like that?
Yes. I mean, I think part of the reason that I decided to start the blog was this is a way to get the recipes out there and really to find other people who are just as interested in ice cream. So I do think that the people that follow my blog and comment on my blog are definitely ice cream fanatics like me. And I think that they like to bounce ideas off of each other and get a lot of flavor ideas and just where to go with their own home ice cream making.
Now, did you get a sense of traveling around with all of this, that certain parts of the country lean in certain directions, sort of like there's a difference between New York cocktails, contemporary cocktails, and San Francisco contemporary cocktails. Did you find ice cream divides up that way, too?
I think that I found that across the country, there was definitely a lot of creative ice cream happening. The difference that is between states is more what inspires the ice cream shops to make their flavors. And so a lot of shops seem to be regionally inspired. So New York might have something different than California, depending on the ingredients that they use. But the creativity is pretty much across the board. I would say that generally more in the Midwest and mountain region, people tend to be more classic with their flavors, and the edges of the United States tend to be a little bit more experimental. But otherwise the creativity is there for everyone.
Well, you know, I don't have a sweet tooth, but I've always loved ice cream. But I always said to Peter for years, I wish they'd make ice cream in the flavors that I like. You know, like eggplant.
Sure enough, they're doing it now.
The ice cream is really a blank slate. That's the way I feel about it. That you make the base, and then you can pretty much experiment with adding any flavor that you want. Not that it'll all taste great, but the majority of it does. I mean, I enjoy putting what a lot of people would consider more savory flavors into ice cream.
That's
like
what
herbs
I was meaning,
and spices,
yes.
And those kind of things.
Yeah.
And they work really well.
Now, you had one ice cream here, which I now can't find. Corn ice cream, which
yes.
I had. If you look on our website under OTM and Pictures, you'll see mm-hmm. me with the most gigantic corn sundae you've ever seen.
Oh, that sounds
which
good.
Which included popcorn and corn caramel. And
of course, Anne says she doesn't like dessert.
But I ate the whole thing.
So I captured this picture of her eating the whole thing. It was in a Peruvian restaurant in London.
Oh.
So it was sort of an unusual
really
sort of place.
Well, you have this blog, and you have, I just see you have popcorn ice, and you have this book, and so where do you go from here? Do you just keep inventing?
There's lots of places to go. First of all, I mean, I'm not going to stop making ice cream. I'm planning on continuing the blog. There are a lot of different flavors that can still be made. I mean, I'm constantly thinking of new flavors, being inspired by different foods that I eat, being inspired by people who give me recipe ideas, so there's definitely still more with that. I do have the dream of opening up my own ice cream shop. I'm not quite there yet, but I would love the opportunity to actually make people ice cream, more people ice cream, because I love seeing the reactions of my friends and family and other people who try my ice cream and just how happy ice cream makes people.
So you make ice cream for yourself and your husband, and you also seem to generate a surplus for people who are fortunate enough to be your friend?
Yes. I make a lot of flavors, and I tend to make several batches at once so I can try all sorts of different flavors. But I try to moderate the amount that I eat, so I share the ice cream a lot, and that's also because, like I was saying, I get a lot of inspiration from other people. And so when they give me a flavor idea, first thing that I want to do is give them a pint of it so that they can try it.
Now, how did you learn the process of making ice cream? Because you have a couple of pages towards the back of the book, curiously mm-hmm. positioned, of some really tips that I guess are really important if you want your ice cream to come out right. But mm-hmm. but how did you learn those things in the first place?
Part of it was trial and error. I inspired in the beginning just from other great ice cream makers out there and their ideas of how to make ice cream. I lived in Ohio when I first started the blog, in Columbus, Ohio, and Jenny's ice cream is right there. She makes a wonderful product, and I went to a seminar with her, in fact, and then I just over time experimented with my own ways of making ice cream, putting different ingredients together, and those are some of the tips that I came up with.
And it's all very doable for the home cook, right? Because you just have a home ice cream making machine?
Yes. I always tell people that it doesn't take any extra tools other than an ice cream maker. And in fact, you can make ice cream without an ice cream maker. There are several different techniques. There's a technique that's on my blog if anybody would be interested. Do you think that if you are a person that likes kitchen gadgets, that it's worth the $50 investment to go out and get an ice cream maker, because it does make it a little bit easier? But otherwise, it's all the things that you normally have in your kitchen in order to make ice cream.
Now, you know that Jenny, we were talking about Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream before.
Mm-hmm.
She's out of Columbus. The Jenny's first ice cream shop venture went bust. You know
yes.
that.
Yes. Trial and error, like I said, it's a good way to learn, and I'm glad she was able to figure out what worked for her, because it's really great.
Yeah, now when she went to the Penn State Extension that does mm-hmm. a lot of, and then she went to a more artisanal one in Ohio. Was it Ohio mm-hmm. State?
I think she went to some. Didn't she go to Cincinnati?
Well, I don't know. Someplace.
I think she worked in. I think she told us that she worked in an ice cream shop in Cincinnati as well.
And she had another course.
Is that what it was?
Okay. Thing, yeah. So, but the difference was between somebody like Penn State Extension, who really was expert in commercially produced ice cream,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the artisanal. And
yes,
so,
I definitely have heard good things about that course. But as you said, a lot of people say it's for bigger commercial. It's also the basics, like this is what we do with our milk, this is what we do with our sugar, this is what we, you know, and kind of breaks it down, enables someone to then do what they want with it.
We had a wonderful ice cream place. The guy was totally mad. First of all, he fell in love with barbecue. He had a gas station, and gas prices went up, and he ripped out his tanks and put in really rough kinds of barbecue pits. And that was half of the business. The other half was ice cream. He went to Penn State Extension and learned about how to make ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And he made wonderful offbeat flavors as well as standard flavors. But the favorite thing I had was you could take him anything and have him make it into ice cream, and he would do it for you custom made.
That's great. Yeah, that's half the fun of it for me.
So, yeah, that would really be cool. Fun. I would love that too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I first started to learn about savories, because, you know, he'd cater an Indian wedding and have to do the cardamom ice cream and stuff like that.
Yes, strawberry and cardamom go really well together. I also made a banana curry ice cream before, so that probably would have worked.
Yeah, that would have been great, yeah. So where would you put this shop?
The one you're going to open, yes.
I currently live in Annapolis, Maryland, and so I would probably put it somewhere around here and or Baltimore. I mean, there's some great ice cream in the area, but I'm really big on those out-of-the-box kind of flavors and really making a good, dense, flavorful product. And I think that I could add something to the mix here.
Yeah, I think it's pretty conservative market there.
Yeah, there's lots of great ice cream and gelato in D.C., and then there's some in the D.C., and then the surrounding D.C. area, and then there's some in Baltimore, but then there's kind of a gap.
Well, I wish you continued success with your blog, and hopefully down the line you could tell us that you have opened and it's a raving success, an exotic ice cream shop.
Yes, that would be wonderful.
Okay, well, thanks for talking to us, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
Well, we had such a good time today talking about sweets. We ran over time, so we better say goodbye before you go away on your own anyway.
Bye-bye.
Yes, next week.